The first intimation that I had had of impending tragedy had come from Mrs. Furneaux, the woman who had taken Margaret into New York. I had been working hard on a portrait and had hardly missed the child. But about 7 o'clock, an hour after she should have been home, the telephone rang, and a gasping voice came to me over the long-distance wire. "Is Margaret with you? Did she come home?" Mrs. Furneaux sounded nearly distracted, but I had managed to drag the details out of her at length. They had gone to the luncheon and then to the matinee in a party, she told me. A little after 5, they had left the others and started for home in Mrs. Furneaux's car. Then, at 34th Street, Margaret had begged for 10 minutes in which to do some shopping in one of the big stores nearby. Mrs. Furneaux had agreed to wait for her and had pulled up in front of the store while Margaret got out and ran inside. And that was all. Mrs. Furneaux had waited for nearly half an hour and then, as she could see that the store was closing for the night, had gone inside to look for her. Not finding her, she had returned to the car. But Margaret had not come out, according to Mrs. Furneaux's chauffeur. So she went back again and searched the nearly empty store thoroughly this time. But she could learn nothing, could find no one who had even seen the child. Margaret had certainly entered the store, for the older woman said she had watched her graceful figure until it passed through the revolving doors. But after that, she had vanished. I nodded grimly. Is there anything else that you know about me? He laughed. Yes, quite a lot. In fact, practically everything. I know that you have considerable independent means, that you are or were fairly successful as an artist, that your parents are dead, that you are an athlete, that in spite of prohibition, you still buy bonded gin and whiskey occasionally by the case, and where you get it, that you haven't by any means given up the hope of finding your sister, and that, here, I held up my hand, and he stopped. Natalie. She looked down for a moment, and when she looked up again, she was her usual friendly, frank self. Well then, why do you talk in that disillusioned way? It isn't a bit like you. Natalie, I know it isn't like me. It isn't even a real side of me. There is a real and vital reason, and that is all I can tell you. Do you believe me? She looked up, laughing. Then, as her eyes met mine, her smile faded into a look of wonder. Do you really mean that? She demanded. Natalie, I have told you the truth. I believe you then, she said simply. And your reason does not matter. Look here, can't we get hold of Captain Peters or somebody and have this charge against me quashed? I demanded. How can I get out and do anything in these duds and with the police looking for me? He shook his head. Can't be done, Clayton. You see, if we exercise pressure and have you cleared, the police force are bound to know about it. We know that some of the officers, at least, are hand in glove with this gang, though we don't know which ones. And then they'd know at once, the gang, I mean, that you were either part of the Secret Service or under its protection. Then you'd be a worse marked man than you are now. You couldn't do a thing then. For we know that they have organized an intelligence service that's damn near as good as our own. They know every move we make almost as soon as we make it. We've had ample proof of that, though they don't know the details, of course. But until it stops, clearing you through the Secret Service would be just about the same as signing your death warrant, unless you went right away and gave the case up entirely. And we don't want you to do that. Anybody there? I whispered, and tried to edge Ivanovich away from the window. He turned swiftly and shut the window. My friend, he said in his even tone, you will be entirely silent, if you please, and do not attempt to look out of the window again, eh? Something touched me, and I looked down. The Russian's hand held a small nickel-plated revolver, and the muzzle of it was nosing the lowest button of my vest. Sorry, he added, smiling, but we must take precautions, you see. You will be careful? I laughed. Well, this is getting to be a melodrama all of a sudden, isn't it? All right, don't shoot. I'll be good. At my first word, the Russian's face lost its mask of good humor for the first time. The lips drew back from even white teeth, and the eyes narrowed into a vicious scowl. "You'll be good and silent," he observed. "Not another word."